We start our last day of deliberations for this month, and we start with business combinations under common control. I give the floor to Julia.
Thank you, Hans. So before we move on to the paper for today's discussion, I would like to start with an overview where we are in the project and where we are heading. So far, we focus the discussions on when each alternative approach should apply. In December, the board discussed whether a current value approach should apply to all or some transactions that affect on CI, and if only some transactions, how the distinctions should be made. In March and April, the board discussed information needs of lenders and other creditors in a business combination under common control and information needs of potential equity investors in an IPO. The board decided to pursue a current value approach based on the acquisition method for some or all transactions that affect non-controlling shareholders. The board also agreed that the outcome of credit analysis would be largely unaffected by whether a current value approach or a predecessor approach is applied. And the board also decided that it does not need to pursue a single approach for all transactions within the scope of the project, and that the board could pursue a current value approach for some or all transactions that affect non-controlling shareholders, and a predecessor approach for transactions that do not affect non-controlling shareholders. So at today's meeting, we would like to discuss whether transactions that do not affect non-controlling shareholders are different from both business combinations under common control that affect non-controlling shareholders and business combinations that are not under common control, and whether a predecessor approach could be appropriate for transactions that do not affect non-controlling shareholders. At the next meeting, we plan to present to you an updated analysis of transactions that affect non-controlling shareholders and of information needs of potential equity investors. We expect that that will complete the analysis on when each alternative approach should apply. We also plan to introduce to you the key questions related to how each alternative approach should be applied and how those main questions would be addressed. As a final note, we are also discussing remaining questions related to when each alternative approach should apply, and also main questions related to how each alternative approach should apply with CMAQ, GPF, and ASAF in June and July, and we will report to you the feedback we receive at those meetings. So with all that background, we plan to ask you to make a decision on when each alternative approach should apply, and after that, we would like to make to move to decisions on how those approaches should apply. So before I hand it over to Simone, do you have any questions on the big picture and our planned next steps?
Sorry, just a very quick question, and may have covered this at a point in time, and I've just forgotten, so apologies if that's the case. In thinking about the two different approaches that we're following, and you've used the term a couple of times in your tee-up saying should apply, are we thinking that the one approach will be an expedient to the other approach and we will allow people to use, for example, the predecessor method, or are we actually thinking that it will be a requirement if you meet certain criteria to use one method or the other, or haven't we really got into that thinking yet?
So I think in principle, and again, the board haven't made a decision where each particular method should be required or permitted, so this is coming. But I suppose it's fair to say that in principle, the staff are thinking that each approach should be required in a particular circumstances, because the whole objective of this project is to address diversity in practice, and it seems to us that to address the diversity we need to, require.
Thank you.
Just looking for some clarification when we're going, where it fits in the process of the predecessor approach. And it's not because of actually the is the wrong word, because I think it's a predecessor approach.
Yes.
And where you expect to give us clarification about what becomes the predecessor approach, what rather than a approach, how that fits in.
I apologize if I used the predecessor approach rather than a predecessor approach, because it's a very important distinction. So at the next meeting, we would like to sort of introduce the main areas where today there is diversity in practice in relation to applying a predecessor approach. And essentially, the question will be which of those alternatives should be required, and that will become the predecessor approach.
Okay. Very good. Simon.
Okay. Good morning, board members. I will now walk you through agenda paper 23A that consider whether transactions that do not affect non-controlling shareholders of the receiving entity are different from both transactions that do affect non-controlling shareholders and from business combinations that are not under common control. This paper is for information only, and the staff plan to ask the board for decision on a package of topics at the future meetings. In developing the paper, we reviewed national requirements and guidance on BCOCC and group restructurings, publications by accounting firms, recent consultations by national standard setters, and responses to those consultations. In our review, we focused on identifying the conceptual rationale for using different measurement approaches in different circumstances. We identified a number of jurisdictions that make a distinction between different types of BCOCC and group restructurings and require or permit a current value approach or a predecessor approach depending on whether specified conditions are met. The staff noted that the effect of the transaction on ownership interests and rights of owners is a common consideration in determining the appropriate accounting treatment. We also noted that considering the effect of transactions on the ownership interest is directionally consistent with the discussions in the BCOC project and the board's tentative decision to explore a current value approach for transactions that affect non-controlling shareholders and a different approach, such as a predecessor approach for transactions between wholly owned entities. The staff explored the application of that logic for different transactions within the scope of the project. I would like to walk you through those scenarios. Scenario 1, on page 8, presents a BCOCC that affects non-controlling shareholders of the receiving entity, Entity A. Before the transaction, non-controlling shareholders have a residual interest and equity claim only in Entity A. As a result of the transaction, non-controlling shareholders acquired residual interest in the transfer entity, Entity B. This transaction is similar to a business combination in the scope of IFRS 3, in how it affects residual interest in Entity B. Accordingly, the same or similar information of IFRS 3 should be provided. Scenario 2, on page 9, presents a transaction within the scope of the project that is not even a business combination as defined in IFRS 3. In this scenario, NewCo is formed to issue shares to acquire Entity A. Economically, the combined entity in Scenario 2 is a continuation of Entity A in a new legal form rather than a new set of economic activities brought together. We think that applying a current value approach based on the acquisition method to a transaction that is not an acquisition may not result in useful information. Let's now move to Scenario 3 on page 10. Unlike the transaction in Scenario 2, the transaction is a BCOCC. However, unlike the transaction in Scenario 1, this transaction does not result in an acquisition of residual interest in the transfer entity by shareholders of the receiving entity. The question arises whether this transaction is more similar to Scenario 1, which results in acquisition of the residual ownership interest in the transfer entity, Entity B, and therefore a current value information should be provided, or whether it is more akin to restructuring in Scenario 2 and different information, such as predecessor information, should be provided. If the acquisition method were applied to this transaction, NewCo would not be identified as the acquirer, and one of the combining entities that existed before, Entity A or Entity B, would need to be identified as the acquirer. Identifying an acquirer is based on the guidance in IFRS 10 and IFRS 3, and the guidance in IFRS 3 looks through the combining entities and to the effect on their owners. Applying the guidance, we think identifying an acquirer in a way that would result in useful information may be not possible in scenario 3. Note that both scenario 2 and 3, parent P retains its original residual interest unchanged, and there are no shareholders acquiring a residual interest in the combining entities. Consequently, a form of predecessor approach could be appropriate in both of those transactions. The staff acknowledge that the conceptual framework considers the perspective of the reporting entity rather than its owners. However, as I've noted earlier, the guidance on identifying an acquirer in IFRS 3 already looks through the combining entities and focuses on the position of the owners of the combining entities as the result of the combination. The staff think that it may be appropriate to extend that logic to determining whether an acquisition is present in the first place. The staff also note that such an approach would be similar to how particular national GAAPs and other sources of guidance make a distinction between different BCUCC and group restructurings and determine the appropriate accounting treatment. Staff's observations are summarized in paragraph 33 to 37, based on our research and analysis in paragraph 10 to 32, we think that transactions within the scope of the project that do not result in non-controlling shareholders of the receiving entity acquiring residual interest in transfer entities or businesses are arguably different from both transactions within the scope of the project that do result in non-controlling shareholders acquiring such residual interest and from business combination not under common control. That is, if non-controlling shareholders of the receiving entity do not acquire a residual interest in the transfer entities or businesses, and the controlling party's residual interest continues unchanged, there is arguably no acquisition that these non-controlling shareholders need information about. Furthermore, identifying a true acquirer may not be possible or may not result in useful information. Accordingly, the staff think that a distinction based on whether non-controlling shareholders of the receiving entity acquire a residual interest in the transfer entities or businesses is a viable approach to explore in determining when to apply a current value approach and when to apply a form of predecessor approach. As highlighted in paragraph 37, such a distinction would be consistent with the board's tentative decisions to date. And with that, we open the floor for discussion.
Thank you. Well, this is a very good, concise, and have a good information, very good paper. Just a clarification, just I have a question. In the case of scenario 3, if you see scenario 3A.2, you are suggesting a kind of a current value approach because there is a change in the ownership of the acquired entity B, right? So this, in this case, if we just apply the US GAAP that was analyzed in your paragraph 14 very clearly, mm-hmm. if there's a change in the ownership of the underlying business, that is a kind of a critical triggering, you know, whether you can apply the, you should apply the current value or predecessor method. So, just a clarification. So, US, following the US GAAP, the scenario 3A.2, this case is what method we should apply under the US GAAP then?
Is slightly different compared to US GAAP because in US GAAP the methodology is for transaction with a high degree of common ownership, mm-hmm. so it's not transaction between entities under common control. But we refer to US GAAP because we had this idea to try to look if there is a change in the ownership in the underlying business. Mm-hmm. And considering this, what we did is we found in other GAAP something that is similar and consistent with our idea. So our idea in scenario 3A.2 is that as long the ownership interest of the non-controlling shareholders of the receiving entity, which is entity A, is changed. So we think that we need to require a current value approach to inform non-controlling shareholders about their acquisition of a residual interest in entity B they did not have before.
Let me start by echoing Chung Wu's congratulations on a good paper. This is a really difficult issue to get your hand around. I think you've done a nice job of organizing the different bits. The first thing was I felt like I had to brush off my – I'm going to have to brush off my U.S. GAAP books and the dust off, make sure I understand what's authoritative and what's sitting outside the authoritative literature's practice, because I was struggling a bit with following 14, in terms of the context of making sure I understood what whether we were pulling from an exception or pulling from the mainstream in terms of U.S. GAAP, and not so much the answers, but the thinking underlying the answers. So, I think maybe I can do that offline, but maybe we want to think about what, if anything, the FASB has in a basis in terms of the beginning of paragraph 14, where you say BCUCC are all a predecessor, as opposed to this closely related scenario of high degree of common ownership. A relatively minor point. Thank you for the very thoughtful analysis of conceptual framework versus thinking in the standards about the change in the underlying ownership, because I think that's the kind of thing we tend to come across at the last minute and go, why didn't we think of this before? In terms of a couple comments, I think if you look at, is it scenario one, I thought it was important what you brought out in the paper. Then when we talk about whether or not there's a change in the non-controlling interest, in scenario one, the non-controlling shareholders were 49% before and were 49% afterwards. And to bring out that what you're talking about is maybe it's not only a change from 49 to 47 or 42 kind of thing, but it's also in situations in which the percentage remains constant, that it's the change in what they own that matters. Because I think when we shorthand it as change in non-controlling interest, people think only of does that 49% number change. So bringing out that it could stay the same, but it's what they own is the other piece of it. And then the last thing that I think we may have to think about, just describing where the borders of any package are. If you look at scenario one, and let's say that before the BCUCC, B had non-controlling interests of 22%, and some or all of that 22% were bought out in the transaction. That's a change in the NCI of the acquired entity. And how, if at all, does that affect our analysis? We've been focused on the change in the NCI of the acquiring company, but if the NCI changed in the acquired company, especially where's the border with any guidance on purchase of, in IFRS 3, purchase of additional interest after you gain control. I'm not trying to add to the scope of this project. I'm just saying I think we have to think about whether the accounting is consistent or different, and if it's different, just think about how the border works and how the two interact. But that's a tidy-up. I don't want to try and say this is an alternative model that we should be considering.
And maybe very quickly to respond to that, that's sort of exactly where we are headed, and maybe it didn't come across clearly enough in the paper, in which case we will sort of re-articulate in the next iteration. But we are focusing not so much on the change in percentage as change in the ownership of the underlying asset. So we are focusing on what? So that's the first sort of comment. And the second comment is we are focusing on whether the non-controlling shareholders acquire something, because that helps us to answer the question, well, is there an acquisition? If they dispose of something, that's not a business combination, that's a disposal, but we will provide sort of comparative analysis on that as well, just to show the distinction.
Okay. Helpful. Thanks.
Gary?
Likewise, a very good paper, and just as one of the board advisors, just some reactions to this project, how it's evolved over time. And I would say the staff work in this project, when I've actually changed my mind, and those of you know me don't know that doesn't happen easily or often, but originally I was of the view since keep everything a predecessor method. We might debate what predecessor method, whether or not there was an NCI or not. And the logic was ultimately it's the parent company is driving everything, and there's enough checks and balances in the systems that you're not paying too much and you're not defrauding, likewise not defrauding your NCIs and so on. But I think over time I've come around to the staff's leaning is that if there's an NCI, it probably should use the acquisition method, you know, either IFRS 3 exactly is written. I don't know if there's any modification, you know, when we're dealing with controlled situations or not, but I think that is the right way to do it. I'd be inclined to say do it without modification. I guess time will tell when the board comes out on that. To me, the only real issue is how small does the NCI have to be before you don't use the NCI method. There's always small numbers of other shareholders, usually by governance, by statute, you must have five shareholders, four of them are just insiders given one share. Likewise, it could just be a very limited employee shareholder plan. You know, they're the only trade among themselves and so on. So to me, that's the only consequential question is either how big does it have to be or how small does it have to be, depending on where you draw the line. I think everything else, I think the predecessor method makes sense in all other circumstances other than when there's a consequential MCI. It, we can draw graphs with circles and lines forever on it, but ultimately if there's not outside money involved, it's all within a controlled group. And all the meetings that we've had, at least that I've been involved in, we're not hearing any consequential demand or need from any sector, preparer, user, regulator, that says that you go to an acquisition method when it's all in a controlled group. You know, from time to time, we've talked about, well, you might be organized these things for an IPO, and that may be true. But I think, keep in mind, IPOs annually are measured in the hundreds, not the tens of thousands, whereas in fact, corporations move subsidiaries around internally all the time for many reasons. Sometimes it's in contemplation of selling either privately or spinning off. But I think most IPOs, and it was just as we were talking, I just skimmed through some statistics on it. You know, regionally they're measured in the hundreds, you know, around the world. But then you say, well, how many of those are private companies going public, including venture capital spinoffs, how many of them are governmental entity control that are privatizing and so on and so on. So I think it's a fairly small universe if we're looking of should we do it because an IPO might happen versus just normal corporate, you know, reorganizing internally for many reasons, most of them unrelated to trying to sell for a business. So to me, predecessor method, and again, whether we pick one or we take, you know, pick and choose the best practices we found, we can work on that, but I think we should stay with predecessor method, in all cases other than when there's a consequential NCI.
Can I just quickly comment on two points that Gary made? So the question about how big or how small, what makes NCI substantive is a key question that we will bring a follow-up analysis on at the next meeting, and we will also discuss it with ASAF. And on the question about how a current value approach based on the acquisition method should apply, again, we've consulted with CIMAC and GPF, we are consulting with ASAF, and we discuss it with the board at a future meeting.
I'm out of
Thanks, Sans.
So like others before me, I really would like to comment because of relatively short paper compared to papers that we've been reading. You were able to. That's very true. I'm not criticizing longer papers. They are necessary from time to time, but I found very interesting that in the 16 papers you really were able to provide a almost complete cover of potential situations. And being a member also of the board advisors on this project and being this the last opportunity to make a few comments in public, I would like just to stress two aspects of your paper that I would call the attention.
And I do agree very much, and those aspects are in paragraphs 34 and 36. I think we are getting the way we foresee to pursue the objectives of these projects are in the right direction. My recent trips to Latin America, this project was raised or identified as one of the most important for the region. It's very, or I would say extremely common because of the legal structure of companies and groups in Latin America. Business combination under common control are extremely common and extremely problematic because of the potential outcomes. And so they are really very keen to see this project going forward. My comment I would like to add is just call the attention was exactly this, the comment Gary made. I think the biggest, I agree with the direction here. I think we should have two models. And I think the biggest challenge is how significant is the NECI. This is one aspect. And considering again the environment that I'm more familiar with, the other aspect that might be challenged for the board is eventually if not only the level of significance of or substance of the NECI, but also the potential relationship between the NECI and the controlling shareholder. Because it's not uncommon to see restructuring before the acquisition that involves someone, sometimes from the same family, or sometimes the controller, individual controller, acquiring a portion, and then eventually to use that aspect as the trigger to use not the predecessor, but use the fair value measurement model, and then get all the potential benefits that are eventually associated with that. I know this is of significant concern for bank regulators because of the potential to create equity or capital that was not there before through the fair value of assets. So I think we are in the right direction, and I just would like to stress this challenge point. It will be, I think, quite significant.
Chen Chao.
Thank you, Hans. So I also appreciate staff's analysis based on different scenarios. I think it's very easy to be understood those different cases and to explore what kind of accounting treatment we should have. Just a couple of comments. First, because the staff's analysis and what kind of accounting policy should have for those BCUCC not affected by NCI. It seems that you also acknowledge that it is based on the shareholders' perspective of those of the acquirer, not from the entity perspective. I think I still was struggling that this kind of actually this is a fundamental change of a basic concept. All our standards developed based on the entity perspective, not from owners, shareholders of that entity perspective. And the only reason you're giving, and you said also this is not consistent with conceptual framework, but you say IFRS 3 currently consider this kind of perspective, but I'm still not very much sure because, and you say that when IFRS 3 try to develop the approach how to determine which entity has made an acquisition and consider this kind of perspective. But when I look at the definition given by IFRS 3 on the acquirer, what's the meaning of acquirer? Acquirer is the entity. It's the entity that obtains control of the acquiree, not the shareholders of the entity control the acquirer. Still starting from the entity perspective. It is the entity A acquire entity B, not the shareholders to acquire entity B. So I think we should still standing from the entity's perspective, it's consistent with the conceptual framework. Also, I think it's still consistent with IFRS 3. I didn't see that there are any areas that IFRS 3 is starting from, not from reporting entity perspective. I always think IFRS 3 and also IFRS 10, that's consolidation, all standing from the reporting entity perspective. And only thing Mary mentioned that I think maybe there is a little areas talking about NCI or all talking about ownership changes. If entity A controlled entity B, and then entity A increasing further the ownership of the entity A, or sometimes entity A, you know, controlled entity B, but entity A still some portions of ownership of entity A, but still retain the control of entity B. In this case, we don't think substantially the nature of the transaction changed. So all those differences between the consideration you received and the current carrying amount go to the equity, I think, based on IFRS 3 or IFRS 10. So because control has not changed. So,
Jinja, can I ask you a question on that very quickly?
Yeah.
Because if I follow that through to the logical conclusion,
yeah,
we would say there is no such concept as common control, because the common control always requires you to look at who's holding above.
Yes. So this is the difference.
Your conclusion would be that every transaction should be IFRS 3 acquisition method.
No. I
sure got that.
What I'm thinking that if we starting from the so-called shareholders, especially NCIs, you know, whether their ownership interests changed or not, I think it's not the starting point we should have. Even we're going to develop.
Every example that's illustrated here, A is buying B. So if I take the, or NewCo is buying A and B. So if I ignore the ultimate parent, parents, or the ultimate structure at all.
I give you a very simple example. For example, I think scenario 3A, scenario 3A2, originally A has NCI 49%, and then A issues shares to acquire B. So that means NCI was diluted, not sell any shares, because simply diluted to 30%. So we regard this kind of ownership interest changes. Actually, it's diluted, not. But I would like to give you another example. If A not issue shares to acquire B, simply pay cash. So that means once A merged or acquired B, NCI, the ownership, actually still keep retain 49%. So ownership interest not changing. So that means whether because of different forms of payment, the nature of the transaction will be different. So this is, I'm wondering whether we're starting from so-called ownership interest, you know, changes will make difference with regard to the accounting treatment of the same or similar transaction. So this is I really quick question. Well, I still would like to starting from who control who, and then you know, develop some kind of, you know.
It just seems to me that, just to understand, it just seems to me that as soon as I'm starting to worry about who controls who, and in the example you're taking, the thing that gets us into this debate in the first place is that P controls both A and B. And so we're looking above the entity level in order to look at control.
Yeah.
That gets us into common control scenario. And it seems to me, it felt to me like that meant that we had already moved beyond the entity view. Now, if we were to say we completely ignore the holding structure and we only look at the entity view, then I think there is no such thing as common control, because that's looking beyond the entity already.
No, so this is the first question I would like to ask. Second question, if we take the control, No, let
May I answer what you've said so far, because otherwise it will be difficult to remember what you said earlier.
Okay.
Difficult to stop you from going in.
So first of all, I would like to go back to your comments on scenario 3A2, and this is actually links to what Mary said earlier. In scenario 3A2, it's not a question what happens with percentage of NCI, and it's not a question of whether entity A issues shares or pays cash to effect this transaction. What happens here is that as a result of the transaction, non-controlling shareholders now obtain residual interest equity claim in entity B. So this is the key. What happens to percentage and whether it's cash or shares is irrelevant. So these guys acquire a share in entity B. This is what matters. And the other thing I wanted to comment on what you said earlier, we completely are in agreement with you about how IFRS 3 defines acquirer. And it's all about control. It's all about one entity being in control over another entity. But if we go to scenario 3, in this scenario, deciding which entity gained control over which entity could be very difficult. And applying the guidance in IFRS 3, you would need to look beyond the reporting entity level, and you would need to look at what happened at the shareholder level. So in this particular case, because the ownership fee continues unchanged, you cannot really identify an acquirer in a meaningful way. And because you cannot identify an acquirer, applying the acquisition method seems quite, strange, I suppose.
Okay, go on. Or do you repent?
So I understand your explanation, because you are trying to look through, you know, the whole transaction. I understand, but if you look at the ownership of interest of those NCI, still, you know, they will not just the ownership of the B. Actually, is A ownership has ownership of B, not the NCI have ownership of B. So anyway, so next. What's the nature of, what's the difference between BCUCC and BCS, as Daniel mentioned? Because if we are going to using the definition acquirer in IFRS 3, there's some problem, because acquirer should control the acquiring. But in this case, because the BCUCC business combination under common control, so people will always question whether entity A really control B. Who control whole decision making? Actually, in many cases, parents decided. And using the word, the paper you said that the parent director, who acquire who control who. So it's, in many cases, it's not the receiving entity can decide. It's the whole group decision. Parents will decide. Maybe A, you know, issue. She has to acquire B. In another case, B can acquire A. It really depends on what kind of accounting outcome or what kind of structure the group should have. So in this case, this is different. We should not ignore the group decision from controlling that, who control whole transaction. I think in some sense, not entity A can control everything. So we should not ignore the final decision maker, that is the parent. So if you look at all those scenarios, we should not ignore the parent there. Parents always direct all those transactions. So this is the main difference between BCUC and business combination. And we should try to identify whether the commercial, you know, substance is different. And so this is also relevant to another question, because...
Can I answer this comment before you move to the next one? So I think it is exactly right that if you have one entity acquiring another entity, and then the acquirer has a parent, of course the parent controls the acquirer, But this logic does not only apply to a business combination under common control. This logic would apply to any business combination. If entity A buys entity B and entity A is controlled by another entity, you can argue, well, it's not A that gains the control, it's A's parent who gains the control over the acquired entity. So it's a very valid argument, but it applies to all business combinations, not just business combinations.
No, just to clarify. The difference is because not entity A. Entity A and B are on common control. So that parents can easily structure, as Amaro mentioned, if those guys would like to fair value to measure those assets liability to be measured at fair value, to overstate assets, it's very easy because parents control all those business. They just structure all those business, move those business from one side, one entity to another side, another entity. It's very.
You should have voted for amortization, Jen Chao.
So this is different. If acquire a business outside the group, it's different. Yeah. What I mean is we should focus on those differences, not focus on those common. If we focus on those common, I think we do not need this subject, this project, yeah. So I think in this case, actually, how to identify acquirer is different from, business, normal business combination. Thirdly, I still would like to mention, because I think we did a very good survey, and based on paragraph 10 and paragraph 11, it seems that the practice currently we have, a large number of the BCUCs actually are using progressive method. So I still would like to, we start from conceptual point of view, start from the user's needs.
Thanks.
Whether all those companies, all those business users, BCUCC are already using precise method, whether those users or investors are happy with those information provided based on precise method, I think plus additional disclosure, or are they really want to change the precise method to current value method, to provide totally another different kind of information, not only at the initial recognition date, but also subsequently, because once you change the measurement basis, that means it will have huge subsequent impact in the future. So whether investors really need this kind of information, I think this is the area we should focus on.
Nick.
Thank you. Like others have said, I found this a very helpful paper, particularly by focusing on the impact of transactions on the underlying economic impact and the interest. And I think Mary's point that actually the shareholding can remain the same, but there can still be a change in the underlying economic interest. And so that's absolutely critical. And I think the paper is a good scene-setting paper in terms of what you're going to bring next month in terms of the information needs of equity investors when there is an NCI present in the receiving entity. And to tie that all together, I think we then need to focus on the economic substance of the transaction and the information that investors require to understand the economic substance of that transaction. Now, that may be the acquisition method, may be modified or not, but I think that's what sets the scene.
Tom?
I was getting a bit confused, but the whole purpose of this project is the under common control is necessary because that's the trigger for a different accounting. And so I think the question, as I understand it, is from Jin Chao, is so you would look to a parent to establish the trigger that you need the different accounting. But as I understand it, you also want to look to the parent to look at the motivation, because they may want to choose, the parent may stipulate, if you give them a choice, they may prefer an accounting where they can boost the asset base by bringing things in fair value. And I think that's something we talked about earlier, and I was sympathetic to trying to minimize the risk of somebody structuring the statements. And I think we came away from that, and when we talked to the CMAQ and GPF, and there was a general faith that regulators would sort of provide reasonable protection, if not 100%, at least maybe close to it, for the minority shareholders and to avoid stuff. And I think one of the big things as we roll along is, do we keep it simple and not think about that problem, or do we think about it? And while I was sympathetic to it initially, I think, at least especially from what we've heard back, is most people seem to believe the regulators will do a reasonable job, so we should keep it simple and just use the parent as a trigger and not think about the parent's motivations in doing this. So.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the debate between Jin Chao and staff member and other members. It's my great honor to observe such an interesting debate. And I have a slight sympathy to what Jin Chao said. We should not ignore the parent, because parent control everything in most cases. I do understand that point. But at the same time, we should not neglect NCS, non-controlling shareholders, as well. So we need to protect shareholders. Then the question is, how can we protect the non-controlling shareholders? One method is to provide such a new, different accounting treatment. The other method is we can require disclosure, or a regulator could regulate. So probably to provide this BCUCC is one of the methods to protect NCS. So having this point in our mind, what we can do is the issue. And I really like the comment made by Yulia to Jin Chao. You said if you compare 3A.2 and 3A.3, so the issue is not the NCI's percentage, but the issue is whether NCI acquired entity B. So that means, so NCS, if you look at NCS, if you put yourself in the shoes of NCS, you have been the shareholders of A, but all of a sudden, you no matter what is your intention, you end up acquiring new company, which is not really not necessarily asset company, and then you have to know what happened with the appropriate information. So therefore, it depends on materiality. NCI should be informed that I acquired entity B. Therefore, I need to know the information about the entity B in a proper way. So that is what we are going to do that. And I really appreciate Yulia's comment. And then if I look at the paragraph 36 seems like to try to explain what is the distinction line. I appreciate the effort. However, the wording is still not very clear, because it only said project that affect non-controlling, because affect means quite a lot of things. And only affect cannot describe what is the heart of this distinction. So I would suggest, to explain what the affect means, and that what is, as Nick pointed out, what is the economic substance is all about. And then explain it and the reason why we think it is right. So that is very important.
Just a very quick comment, and I completely agree with what you said. In paragraph 36, actually, in the second line of the paragraph, what we say, we're talking about distinction based on whether non-controlling shareholders of the receiving entity acquire residual interest in the trans. So this is what we mean. Yeah. So later in A and B, we're using a little bit of a shortcut, I suppose, but it's the second line in paragraph 36, which is the key.
Yes, I do understand. But because we have A and B as if it were criteria, so rather than having the first paragraph is just explanation, but if you have A and B as if it were criteria, then we should explain a little.
We'll clarify.
Yes.
Yeah.
Martin.
Only a short comment. I think it's a good paper,
And but what you said in the introduction, man, what are the next steps? Man, I've said, I think already said, I think twice, because man, I'm struggling to make decisions what method should be applied without discussing the predecessor method in detail. Because I don't have any clue what it is. When I heard about it, I have not seen it. I think it is carrying values of the acquired entity, maybe, but what you happened with the difference between what you paid and what is in the mm-hmm. net asset, I don't know what we're doing with that. And therefore, I think as a one of the next steps, we need a discussion about what we mean by predecessor and what we think is the method. Because otherwise, at least for me, it is difficult to say, okay, is that still appropriate for some kind of acquisitions?
And this is pretty much what we plan to do. So at the time when we ask you to make a decision on when to apply each method, at that meeting, we'll give you an overview of all sort of key questions related to how a current value approach and how a predecessor approach would apply. But it's a little bit of a chicken and egg question, I suppose. We need to start making decisions somewhere. We cannot not make any decisions and then make 10 decisions at the same time. So we need to sequence the topics. But we will provide you an overview, and hopefully it will give you enough.
Yeah, would be good.
Okay. Okay. Well, good paper that has been rewarded with a rich discussion.
Thank you.